Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back today with part two of Bruce Hedlund's conversation with YouTube sensation turned five-time Grammy winner, Jacob Collier. We left off our last episode with Jacob talking about what it's like to perform to an audience of thousands of people after growing a fan base entirely online. In this episode, we'll hear Jacob play the piano and go deep on music theory. It's honestly pretty extraordinary. It isn't every day that a musician of Jacob's caliber takes the time to sit down at a piano and really break down his creative process and the theory behind it. He also talks more about his new album, Piano Ballads, and about how the old standard Moon River taught him the power of centering his avant-garde arrangements on emotions. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Hedlund and Jacob Collier.
One of your early experiences on stage, I read, was you sang in a couple operas. I think you sang in Fozzik and Magic Flute. But then you did Benjamin Britten, The Turn of the Screw.
Yeah.
And you said, I think it was his harmonies, like blew your mind or something. Now, I thought I would have to sit here and pretend to understand Benjamin Britten. Yeah. And that was making me very nervous. And I do like the interludes from Peter Grimes.
Oh, well, yeah, aren't they amazing?
Since I didn't know, I reached out to two people who do know. One's my brother, Phil, who's a conductor in Europe. Actually, he used to teach at the Royal Academy.
Oh, he did?
I think, yeah. And my other is my brother, Dave, who's he's a music theorist at Eastman.
Wonderful.
So I said, what do I possibly say about this? They say Britten's harmony is not defined by something in and of itself. But here's how they relate it to you, and maybe this is why you liked it so much. Your negative harmony uses what theorists call inversion. Tell me about negative harmony and how you use it.
So negative harmony is quite an ancient idea. It's an idea based in polarity. So the idea that what goes up must go down. You know, a tree has branches that grow up and roots that grow down. And it happens in nature. And so I had a teacher of mine when I was at the Royal Academy for a couple of years. His name was Barak Schmuel. And Barak studied with a very, very great saxophone player called Steve Coleman. And Steve Coleman is just one of the deepest musicians who's alive. And he has got very deep into studying certain musicians. There's one that he cites, his name is Ernst Levy, who wrote a book called A Theory of Harmony. And I've dipped into this book, and it's dense, but fascinating. and the idea is actually really simple. You know, it's the idea that if you have a melody that goes, you know, and you reverse every direction, what goes up must go down. So the reflection of this is this, right?
So when you say the reflection, if there's a full tone up, it's a full tone down.
Exactly, yeah. It's like you put a mirror at this note, and this is up a tone, so that goes down a tone. Right, like that. So yeah, the idea is very simple. So Steve has thought about this as a melodic idea. You know, so a phrase, you know, like that. You know, and if I flip that, it's... Yeah. That's the reflection. That kind of thing. So it's a really amazing melodic device. But for me, I mean, you know me, I'm all about the harmony. So I think the thing that I gravitated towards the most was the this in a harmonic sense. So if I'm in the key of F major, in classical music, you think, well, how would I get to F major? Well, I would get there from a C7 chord. Right? If I say 5-1. So what Ernst Levy describes as one possible axis of reflection is the idea of you take F and C, which is our kind of home key, and this F and C, the note exactly between F and C, so them as a duo, that becomes the reflection point, the mirror. And if I reflect C7 over that axis, then you come up with this sound. Right. So. And I mean, you can imagine when I first heard this, I thought, oh man, that's so thrilling. The idea that the reflection of the dominant chord is as led to the key. Because if you think about C7, this note, which is a B flat, this wants to sink. That's where it wants to go. Right, so you've got this note wants to sink. That note wants to rise. And in this, that note wants to sink. You know, see that? So the gravity is equivalent. That's the crazy thing, is that it's the same amount of gravity to F. But it's reflected. So in classical music, you might have, or even in jazz, you might have something like... It's like a 6-2-5-1 cadence. And so if you do that with negative harmony, you get this amazing... like that. It's a different flavor. So you say, how do I use it? Well, I wouldn't claim to have the deepest understanding of polarity and all of its permutations musically, but I think that the concept of that really got me excited, because in a very basic way, it's plagalizing every perfect cadence. And when we see plagal cadence, it's like a 4-1 instead of a 5-1. So 5-1 is this, and 4-1 is this, right? It's almost like a more of a gospel sound. So rather than going... Yeah, right. It's going... like what James Taylor would do, you know. Or Joni, if Joni goes... What she doesn't do is... She goes... Right? Plagal. It's a plagal cadence, and then it's a plagal cadence on the plagal cadence, and you can even do a plagal one on that, and then on that. So you can actually do like, instead of, and that's so cool to me. 4-4-4-4-4-1, and so. Do I think about this when I'm improvising piano battles on stage? Consciously, no. But what I have done is familiarize myself with the materials of what that feels like in my own experimenting at home and practicing, and understood that. The feeling of that being different from... this is like a brighter version, and then the negative version is darker. Bright and dark, that's a universal thing. Mm-hmm. You won't meet a person or a creature or any living thing that does not understand bright and dark. It's such a huge thing. And obviously these things are very subjective, but musically talking, if I arrive at F major, from there, it feels very different from if I... arrive from there. I mean, it's so exciting. That's the negative one, and the perfect one being, you know.
So what's the negative version of the dominant seventh?
You would describe it as like the 4 minor 6 chord. So in F, it's B flat minor 6, like that. Or you could also describe it as the second degree of the scale, half diminished. So G half diminished to F. Rather than
and
C,
half diminished is that's the Tristan chord.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is indeed.
And that's something Benjamin Britten used a lot.
Britten had a way with harmony, which still to this day, I mean, no one has touched him for the thing that he has done. But he was one of the only composers in the 20th century who didn't go down the 12-tone route. You know, he didn't go down the serialism route. He didn't go down the kind of neoclassicism route so much. And he didn't go down the kind of austere atonal stuff or highly mathematical stuff. He just kind of continued a harmonic language on his own terms. And it was really based in kind of folk music because mm-hmm. of being English and also just, I think, just being so deeply involved in the harmonic language of what had just come before him. But
I thought Turn of the Screw had a 12-tone theme.
It does have a 12-tone theme, which is, that's like the opening theme, which I just absolutely love. But I guess when I say he didn't embrace 12 tonality in a total form, it was part of his arsenal. Mm-hmm. He would draw on it to tell a story, a harmonic story based in his otherwise kind of fruiting language. But the 12 tone thing, there were certain people who wrote music purely based in
sure.
that as a form. And I think Britten had a way of alchemizing all that was going on around him, but he didn't do it for that being the sake of it. He didn't live and die by that conceptually. And I think he was able to pull from it and tell these stories. The thing with Britten, to my mind, is, you know, he'll do this chord where it's as much about the notes that aren't there than the notes that are there. You know, a chord like that. I don't know whether Britten's used this chord. Maybe he has, but...
Now, what do you... Just tell me what you're playing there.
Well, that chord, you could describe it as like an A dominant chord with mm-hmm. a ninth, but it's a very strange voicing. An A dominant chord with a ninth is this, right? But if you do just that, there's no E, there's no E. If I did that, it's much more palatable. But Britten has a way of these things shining here. And your ear hears the gaps. It's like these big gaps. And yeah, there's like an austerity to it, like a cold water nature to it. But there's also a huge power and a delicacy. And he's just able to command such extraordinary tapestries of color and sound. And I mean, another thing that was going on in the 20th century, even before that, I think Britten used beautifully was the idea of kind of bitonality. You know, you have one part of the music in one key and then another part in a totally different key. And if you had there's something very sweet up here, yeah, these really kind of this amazing, it's an amazing feeling because your mind is led in one direction by one and one direction by the other. And there's one aria in the Turn of the Screw called Marlowe, which I sang as a boy. Yeah.
Marlowe, 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 I would rather be.
And it's this beautiful, like really haunting, innocent kind of thing. And beneath it, especially towards the end of the production, all sorts of really emotional, deep chords going underneath the surface, and it just maintains this purity. So, you know, I didn't understand those chords at that age. And I mean, even to this day, I haven't sat down and gone deep in analysing them, but the feeling of being a part of those chords as a member of the cast has stayed with me for life. And the idea of being that part of the chord, or outlining that part of the innocence of the chord and the storyline, its reference to the darkness underneath. I mean, it's just so rich and so beautiful. And I think that I approached that music at that time completely without analysis. It was because I was 12, you know, and I was missing a bunch of school. It was really exciting. I got to skive off lessons and go to Spain and learn this really dense, rich music. And I felt like I emotionally really understood it. I understood it, you know, far more than a lot of the having mates and doing stuff that kids do and having to socialize with children. I didn't get that as much as I understood Britain. With Britain, it was like, oh, I understand what's going on here. I can emote and relate to this as a form.
Now, you said it's a different chord, the way you're playing it, in the right hand and in the left hand. Are they related harmonically, or are they two completely different thoughts?
Well, they can be related harmonically. I think normally there's a sense of gravity that each holds, and In the world of Britain, this has, the D major has all of its own gravities, and C has its gravities at the same time. And they don't have to connect. There doesn't have to be like, wah, wah, you know, it's so boring when you think about harmony in that way. So, and I think I used to think of everything as a scale, everything as one unified sound, that everything had to be connected and analyzed vertically. Mm-hmm. But now I think I'm getting more of a kick out of horizontal harmonic thinking, which I suppose is more in line with someone like Bach, who writes these amazing four-part things, but I don't think he necessarily thought about like, okay, F major, C major, D. He thought, this melody is going here, and this melody is going here. They connect in that way. And harmony is a byproduct of melody in that situation.
We'll be right back with more from Bruce Hedlum and Jacob Collier after a quick break.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with more from Bruce's conversation with Jacob Collier.
You have a video. You have many wonderful videos, but there's one with you and Herbie Hancock.
Oh, yeah.
That I'm thinking of now watching you play, whereas he describes, and I'm wondering if this is related, in playing jazz, he says, well, play the arrival chord in the right hand and then play the chord that's getting there in the left hand.
Yeah. There's this tune that Herbie taught me called Don't Follow the Crowd, which is a killing tune. And there's one moment in the tune where it goes... that. Right. So you could harmonize that as a good old-fashioned A flat 7. But Herbie talks about the idea of it being a C7. Oh, it's just so great. And then up to there. So he thinks about the right hand being essentially disconnected from the left hand, because the left hand's going 5-1 and the right hand's going C D flat, just chromatic. Right. And Herbie would say that comes from the 20s, you know.
It's very chromatic.
Yeah, chromatic, yeah. Approach rather than, functional. But I think my instinct is always to try and think of things vertically first. So I was trying to think, how can you make that fit? You know, because you've got a dominant 7 and a major 7. So you actually got all three of these notes at the same time. But it's great, you know, and I like it because it tears the rule book up. And I think that's also why Herbie likes it, because Herbie's such a maverick, you know, that guy. He loves getting inside the cracks of these things and finding chords that feel right. I mean, the first time I ever met Herbie was in Montreux in Switzerland in 2014. And the first conversation we had was like, hey, man, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And within 2 minutes, we were talking about minor ninths. It was just like, hey, man, love minor ninth. This is just minor ninth. Sounds like this, you know. It's really gnarly kind of interval. But if you put a minor ninth in the right place, then it can be so beautiful. So say, for example, this. It's such a beautiful, austere sound. You know, or if I spread that out. You know, these kinds of bubbling sounds. You know, there's so many cool things that you can do with that interval, which you could say is the reflection of that interval. And a major seventh is also a very important interval. But it was just fun to sit in this restaurant with Herbie over chicken, and we were just talking about minor ninths. It was one of the moments where I thought, what is my life, you know, right now? Sitting with Herbie Hancock and talking about minor ninths, this is crazy, you know. Over the years, Herbie's become a really great friend, you know, and also a mentor. And I think I've learned so much from him, and sitting down and listening to how he thinks and talks and plays, and so many life lessons with Herbie. It's not just musical lessons. It's not sitting down, Herbie shows me a hip new voicing. It's you know, Herbie talks so much about, you know, permission and fearlessness and how music comes straight from life and all these kinds of things. So a minor ninth, that doesn't exist in a stuffy old textbook in the back of a library in some, you know, godforsaken music theory book. It exists because it holds tension in the present now. That is the sound now. How do you use that? It's so expensive, you know, what expensive thing to use. And if I'm singing wise men say, right, that is a minor ninth. Or I could equally do, which is that minor ninth there. And suddenly we get into Britain territory again. You know, the idea of things that rob, you know, Britain would use a chord like that instead of, like, you know, it's like a chord like this. You could call this a D11 chord, which is cadences to G. Well, why is that chord so emotive? Well, you could say, you know, because blah, 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 has notes in it, blah, scales, blah, blah. But that's not why. It's emotive, I think, because the G is already home. It's already home. Britain did this wonderful arrangement of, I think maybe even composed it. It's called the New Year Carol, and it goes.
Mm-hmm.
tune. And that chord, why is that so special? Well, because he could have just done... Yeah. He kind of does a similar thing. But no, he keeps this. He keeps it. It's like a constant. It's like, oh, it's a steadfast. The steadfast at home. And even though we're not at home, we've got this chord, we're still home at the same time. And you've got minor ninth, there's the sacred minor ninth, they're fighting, but it's resolved and unresolved at the same time. I mean, that's such a human feeling. Oh, it's just beautiful. And I mean that... And so where does an understanding of those sounds come from? It doesn't come from reading books. It doesn't come from taking music classes. It comes from listening with an open mind and then playing with the things that move you about it. And getting inside a sound. And, you know, and again, it's a lot of this stuff is so subjective, but I think that that's one thing that Britten does so well is he controls tension in a very sweet but yet very dark way, where he's able to kind of leave space for your ear to intuit a part of the harmony that is maybe even not there, or feel something, visualize common tones throughout music. But I don't think he thinks about this in a theoretical way. I think that's just his soul, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting things about this album is you can hear the audience reaction. Mm. And there are times you're improvising and they don't know where it's going. And I'm not sure you can even hear it, but there's a sort of tension.
Yeah.
And this happens in a lot of concerts, but more so in yours because they don't know where you're going. Suddenly you begin, say, Let It Be.
Hmm.
You really took a long time to get to Let It Be. People are like, whew, that's a relief.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I decided necessarily that was definitely the song I was going to play until I ended up here. I thought, okay, I may as well go, when I find myself, you know, and that was all.
I guess what interests me about it is there is this tension in popular music. And we're talking about Benjamin Britten, we're talking about Herbie Hancock, but you're very much in the pop world as well. There's always been this tension between musical knowledge and ability on one hand and simplicity and what is thought of as sincerity on the other hand. You know, progressive rock, punk rock.
Yeah.
People prefer punk rock.
Right.
Country is famously called three chords and the truth.
Yeah, right.
Are there some songs that you simply can't do this level of reharmonizing on? It surprised me, for example, you did Tennessee Waltz.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very kind of traditional.
Yeah.
It's probably a 1-4-5.
Yeah.
Are you in the middle of some songs going, you know, the song can't take this?
Yeah. There are definitely moments where a song does not guide you to being reimagined heavily harmonically. There's one song on the album called All at Sea, which is maybe my favorite song on the album. It's a song by a guy named Jamie Cullum, who's just one of my favorite musicians from England. And it's funny, I didn't do any reharms. Well, I did a couple of sneaky ones, but I didn't fundamentally reharmonize that song because for some reason, maybe it was my mood or whatever. But the song, it just kind of... I'm all at sea when no one can bother me. Oh God, my rules. If only for a... It doesn't need, you know, it doesn't need that. It just sings. And one of the joys of improvising is that you have to take yourself as who you are on that day. So I remember when I did Tennessee Waltz, that was the fifth show in a row that we'd done. We'd done, I think it was two Copenhagen shows, a Sweden show, one more show, which I'm forgetting now. And then Oslo was the final of the five shows. So I was exhausted, but I was also very kind of hyper. And my really dear friend, Stian Carstensen, who's a totally unbelievable Norwegian button accordion player who also plays banjo and kaval and pedal steel. He actually brought his pedal steel for this. And I asked him to sit in on the song. Tennessee Waltz is a fun place to start because it's a song that kind of everyone knows, especially musicians, you know, really, really know that song. That, I mean, it's such a great song that it can survive some pretty severe departure. But I think for me, the thing I like about that performance with Stian is that both of us have this way of climbing around and doing all sorts of weird, funny things. But the song is like a North Star. You know, it guides us back, and then we'll go off and do the bunch of stuff, and then suddenly we'll land at the song again, you know, and it brings us back home. So, you know, but then again, I think if I thought, oh gosh, I really shouldn't do this to the song, or, oh no, that would be inappropriate, you know, or whatever. These principles, oh, I think less is always more, or, you know, you really have to, you know, treat these things with respect. And I don't think that's not how life works. And I also don't think that is a sound way of learning. I think that you have to give yourself permission to try it all. I think when I was a teenager, I kind of, you know, irrespective of the song, sometimes I would take these things way out. Mm-hmm. And I think now I'm more inspired by the idea of kind of controlling the density of the language in favor of the songs that are being sung and the stories that are being told through the songs. And I think that's one of the things I'm enjoying about growing older, actually, mm-hmm. is, you know, if I look at myself 10 years ago when I was 18, so much of the language was so new and I needed to push it that far. You know, if someone had, I mean, people did try and tell me this, I didn't listen, but if people say, you know, just calm down, don't do less chords, you know, just play the simple song, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like telling Stevie Wonder not to make Where I'm Coming From. It doesn't work. You can't make someone different from who they are. And it's not in anyone's best interest. I mean, why am I making music? I'm not making music for other people to like it. I'm making music because I must make it. It's part of my skeleton. It's part of my expression. And I think that it's only in giving people the permission to be their full, authentic selves that you end up with a person that is actually grounded in the truth of who they are. And again, when you grow older, one of the things about growing older is that your understanding as to your language and how to use it, I think it deepens and grows as you become older. So I think I'm now much more inspired by, I mean, you could say simple chords, but triads. I mean, simple, you know, these simple things I really adore, like the clarity of these kinds of sounds. When I was 16, all I wanted to do was think, yeah, they're such cool sounds, you know. But I'm glad that I went through that, and I'm glad that I've come into the triadic world with those experiments in tow, because it means mm-hmm. that if I'm playing, you know, Wise Men Say or whatever, there might be a moment where I do sprinkle a chord that's quite expensive, followed by a simple chord, and then you get into really painting with that language.
It wasn't a question of should people have permission to experiment, because of course they always should. Mm. It's the degree to which a tune can absorb that kind of treatment. You know, rhythm changes are a lot of the big jazz songs are built that way. You know, right. I'm thinking one of, because I do like country music, and I like the pleasure of the three chords. You know, one of my favorite versions of a country music song is, do you know Ray Charles doing You're My Sunshine?
I think I've heard that, yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. Stunning. But I don't think he does much. I think it's a lot of...
He just sings the song.
It's a lot of rhythmic stuff.
Yeah.
It just moves like nobody's business. Oh, but I don't actually think he does much substitution.
Yeah, yeah.
But to me, and maybe it's almost a self-consciousness that, do I like music that's too simple?
Yeah, oh, no, know, I don't think that. I don't think there's such a thing as that.
It's hard as a listener sometimes, you know, I mean, because the pleasures are very kind of well-regulated, you know.
Yeah.
Willie Nelson's a nice guitar player. There's a lot of fabulous guitar playing in country, but it's based on that foundation. They're not throwing in a lot of half-diminished.
No, and I love it for that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think certain songs can survive being kind of messed with, and other songs do kind of just fall apart.
We'll be right back after a quick break with more from Jacob Collier.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with the rest of Bruce Sedlem's conversation with Jacob Collier.
I wanted to ask you about Moon River because you once said that's a song that taught you a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
It's another one of these songs like Can't Help Falling in Love, where every note in that melody is in the major scale. So what's that song taught me? It's very simple, but it has such a journey intervallically. So when I say intervallically, it's like the arcs of the melody are so lovely. It's like a rainbows, you know? It's like a line mm-hmm. that's drawn like this. And those shapes are so strong that I think it held my language together a little bit. Because, you know, I came with that song ravenous for some chords. And I thought, oh, I really want to take this song out on a journey. And then there are times where the song will dictate, no, you stay within my world. You stay within the key that it's in. And then there are moments where it almost physically... It says fly, go fly, and I'm thinking, okay, whoosh, and all my language comes out, and I just think that kind of almost spiritually, I think that song is so beautiful, and it's just the idea of the wonder of the world opening up before your eyes, and almost having this going on a journey as with a companion. wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. It's imagining a world that is endless and large and big, and that you could share. We're off to the same rainbow's end, waiting around the bend, my huckleberry friend. It just describes a feeling, and I think some of my favorite songs describe a feeling, either through the lyrics or just through the chords and the melody, rather than being about, it's about this person or it's about this experience. It's about a feeling of the world, because that song, it opened my mind to a lot of stuff. And also, I think harmonically, I really kind of pushed the boat out down Moon River and really kind of wanted to find new things. The final verse of that 8-minute arrangement actually is in a key that does not exist on the piano. It's like between E flat and E.
Oh, you did.
And it's actually not on the piano. It's a quarter tone away. But there's a portion at the end of the arrangement after that where I move between all these keys that aren't on the piano. And it's something I've been very, very excited by and interested in for some time. But I really, in a musical sense, the arranging that song gave me a lot of understanding as to how to achieve things in a microtonal world, but based in the emotions of a song that kind of held it together.
So how does that work? What's the emotional effect of switching to not a semitone, but a semi-semitone,
microtone? Yeah, microtone. Well, it's the same feeling as changing key chromatically on the piano. If I'm playing Moon River, I've changed key or whatever. Moon River. And me. Right. So, it's a new world. It's a different thing. Well, what's different about these keys? It's different color, different flavor, different feeling. So with microtonal keys, it's the same thing. It's just even more subtle. So, if you, for example, are aware of only the major scale, and you go, right, this all sounds good, or pentatonic, and every style of music in the whole world pretty much incorporates the idea of this pentatonic scale. It's a universal thing. And if I go, I say, oh, that doesn't fit. That note is not in my language. Oh, it feels really out and strange. How could anybody ever use that note? Why would you do that? But actually, you can do it. Say if I take the E and I pivot, then I'm there. So the same is true with microtonality. I think right now, based on the last 500 years of musical instruments that have been built in 12-tone equal temperament, which is the idea that every semitone is the same size and there are 12 notes in an octave. There are lots of other ones. There's 31 note equal temperament, which is I'm actually a huge advocate for. I think it's really good. And so instead of, it's like, etc. And all these individual notes, they're all, It's the same thing. You can pivot to notes that feel outside. I can pivot from to, even though that note feels, oh my God, no, that's wrong. It's a wrong note. It's like, no, it's not wrong. And there are all sorts of ways you can pivot, using things like just intonation, which is like a system of tuning based in physics and harmonic ratios and things like that. It's just that our ears aren't awake enough to it. In the same way that if we are pentatonic people and someone goes, you think, well, that's just never going to be in my system. It's not in the system. It's wrong. Mm-hmm. And assuming sometimes we have a way of thinking, that's wrong. It doesn't fit into my system. What a damaging and dangerous concept, politically, conceptually, philosophically, energetically, to say, you don't belong in this because it doesn't fit in my system of understanding. And think of the opportunities we have to connect with each other and ideas, but we shut them down because we are close to our own systems. And all of us do this. I mean, I do this in many aspects of my life because I'm a human too, but I try not to, because I think that music, which has taught me so many things, definitely teaches me to welcome things. And the idea of, not being a wrong note, but more just like an opportunity to go somewhere else, is way cooler as a way of thinking than thinking, well, that's just wrong, rule it out.
So when you did Moon River, did you change it electronically, like post-production, or did you adjust the instruments, or was it all vocal?
It was all vocal. So it was it's about 100 voices at once. It's a massive sound. And that's what, I mean, it's the reason why I think the voice is the most kind of important and versatile instrument of all. But yeah, I just sang it in as I wanted to hear it.
Having perfect pitch, does that allow you to hear the in-between notes as well?
Well, it's funny because, you know, perfect pitch is one, you would say, oh, you know, it's absolute pitch, I can pluck a note out of the air. But I mean, it's just based on the notes that we've been given. So we've been given 12 available notes. And I think now I'm excited to kind of expand my, you could say, perfect pitch into more than 12.
Have you played Harry Partch instruments?
Well, so I've never played one of his instruments, but Harry Partch is one of the most kind of important pioneers of microtonal instruments. There have been so many people over the years who have attempted to solve the problem of how do we make our chords sound really good, but also put them in equal temperament. So, yeah, I mean, not to get too nerdy, but every note in the universe has a set of overtones. So if I say, which is a B flat, if I go, I don't know if you can hear, but it's going. There's overtones coming. So this is naturally occurring. So if I go, in a cathedral, which people did hundreds of years ago, no doubt, you hear those overtones come back at you. And so within every note, it's actually inherently a major chord. It's crazy. So this is why I think major feels consonant to human beings, is because that sound is, if I go, it's in the chord, it's in the note. It's in every sound. So of course our ears seek to hear that. The thing about the piano, which is a compromise harmonically, is that the third, that D, the third on the piano, is actually, it's actually really sharp on the piano. In real life, in physics, you could say everything's real life, but you see, it's really sharp, but the pure tone, we call it the justly tuned third, is 14 hundredths of a half step or a semitone flatter than the piano is tuned. So this is crazy to me. What does this mean? Well, it means that you can pivot to microtonal keys. And this is the thing that really freaks me out. So if I take the D, and that's now my tonic, then my entire chord is 14 cents flat. So now if I do, that's a D major chord. The third of that chord would itself be 14 cents flat. So now my F sharp is, which is quite a lot flatter than the one on the piano. And then that itself can become a major chord. And then the third of that is 14 cents flat. So by this point, we are, what's my math? 42 cents flat, which is almost half a semitone flat. So this is how, at the end of Moon River, and also in other arrangements I did, I actually moved between microtonal keys. I'm not just jumping there. I'm pivoting using just intonation ratios, harmonic physics-based intervals, to guide the ear to a place where it doesn't know or sense anything is wrong or untoward. Because it's the same way as pivoting to A major from C major, but using the E. I don't feel like I've gone huge. It's not like going, you know, it's not like you're not jumping to a foreign place. You can do that, but the thing I'm really, really, really excited and interested in right now is how do you unpack microtonality, but completely in functional chord systems and functional harmony, because there's also people who make microtonal music that sounds really unlistenable and is very intellectual and is just really jarring, and it can be very beautiful as well. But I think for me, the idea of using these justly tuned chords and intervals, pivoting using those sounds, I mean, that's crazy, man. That's so exciting.
You're now on the hunt for ghost notes, those between the notes. What's next for you?
Well, we haven't spoken about this too much, but I'm in the middle of a quadruple album. This is besides the Piano Ballads album. Jesse, volume 1, 2, 3, and 4. And each of the volumes of Jesse has been a different, it's like a different musical genre, different musical space, different set of sounds. And so it's like a 50-song, sprawling, kind of insanely ambitious project that I began 4 years ago now, or over 4 years ago now. I wanted to lay down the foundations of my own musical understanding so that at the end of the fourth volume of Jesse, I could like start my career. That was like my plan. And the way I wanted to learn was by collaborating with all my favorite musicians, musicians I believe to be the most kind of extraordinary, important people to me. And some of those people are old legends and some of those people are 10 years younger than me. But I was really, really ravenous to collaborate because I just made this album in my room and I toured it for 3 years on my own on stage. And I just really wanted that human connection. So I started this project. So Jesse Volume 1 was an orchestral album. And by no means was it classical music, but it was music, just music made with an orchestra and my mind and instrument skills too. And so there was that. The Take 6 were on the album. Lauren Ravula was on the album. All sorts of amazing people. And Jesse Volume 2 was more of a sort of a folk record, I suppose, a record based out of the guitar and writing songs. And that album was packed with collaborations too. Sam Amidon, Catherine Tekel, Leanne LaHavas was on the album, Jojo, Umu Sangare from Mali was on there, and she's extraordinary. And Steve Vai, the legendary rock guitarist, was on there. Jesse Volume 3 was more of a kind of R&B, I hesitate when I say pop, but it was the most pop album I've ever made. These songs had electronic production, four on the floor, sorts of things, as well as, you know, really kind of dense experiments. And that album was T-Pain and Jesse Reyes and Tori Kelly and Mahalia, Ty Dolla Sign, Kiana Lede, some really extraordinary people, Rhapsody. So what's next for me? Well, Jesse Volume 4 is on the horizon, and that is, it's been a couple of years in the works and more excited by it than I can possibly say. It's been a challenge to kind of contain the overwhelmingly dazzling potential of what it could sound like and be in my mind, because there's just so many things. But it's finding its north, it's finding its form, and it's really getting to the point where it's approaching a finished state now. I think within a few months it should be done. So that's cool. One of the things I'm most excited about is I actually recorded every audience on tour for the album, and so it's like 100,000 voices singing in harmony on the record. And mm-hmm. I think to me, that's so exciting and feels philosophically very correct, because I began my career layering my own voice on top of itself to create harmony, right? And it's almost like I posed the question, what is harmony? What is connection? If harmony is the connection between things, what am I seeking here? What began as a journey in isolation, and it's by no means ending, but it's definitely the end of an era, this Jesse era, the last 5 years of my life. What have I learned? Well, I've learned that everyone in the world has a voice. And what happens when you bring those voices together, that's as much harmony, philosophically harmony, as I could possibly dream of conceptualizing. That is a feeling, that is a north, that's the special thing. And so I'm really excited to incorporate their voices onto the album. I'm then excited to tour that album with the audiences themselves singing what they sang. You know, there's this amazing kind of loop that goes around. Yeah, I'm working on so many other things besides Jesse Volume 4, some of which I can't talk about. In fact, most of which I can't talk about, but with all sorts of different people on many different stages and different environments in many different forms of art. And I think I'm just fiercely ambitious, but I'm also just trying to stay as in the present as I can with what I can pay attention to and give my energy to right now. And right now that's finishing Jesse Volume 4, which I'm so proud of and so excited to share, and finishing off this world tour this year, which is Australia, New Zealand and Asia, and a little bit of Europe for good measure. And then, you know, soaring into the campaign of the album, which is creating videos and creating narratives and having conversations. And there'll be a tour for that album, I'm sure, in the future, and after the album comes out. And, you know, then I think the biggest challenge for me is leaving a blank page so that things can take me by surprise, you know, because I could plan the next 10 years of my life and actually fill every day. So I think it's almost a matter of just thinking, well, let's just leave room for things to come and surprise me and people to come and surprise me and for me to be swept off my feet a little bit, you know, by the things that happen in life that you can never plan for. But it's almost like improvising a ballad. You go on stage or you step forth in life, and there are certain things that you can hold on to. There are certain parts of language and knowledge you understand, and then you have to just let it all go and see what happens.
Well, thanks for spending this time with us. You swept us off our feet. It was just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to Jacob Collier again for sitting down to talk to us about his career and about his process and about some insane musical theory. You can hear Piano Ballads and all of our favorite Jacob Collier songs on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter @BrokenRecord. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, Jennifer Sanchez. Our editor is Sophie Crane. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.